$100 million into a movie project, but we can. That is our competitive advantage. Hollywood has always sought a competitive advantage. When television threatened it, the movies went to widescreen, or 3D, or even R-rated. I remember when Francis Coppola invested in something called Smell-O-Vision. As the technology of the movie craft changes, so do the movies we make. The two are intimately bound together. Cinema follows a developmental path that straddles commerce and technology. It always has. When sound came in, it changed movies. Their art was now a completely different art. The high art reached in the great silent films was gone. No one wanted to make or see new silent films anymore, no matter how great. So much for the art. Changing technology has always ruled this art form. The invention of the typewriter didn't fundamentally change writing from the days of the pencil, but the introduction of sound did change movies. I would argue that the introduction of digital changed movies again like never before. Digital cinema makes possible non-existent but realistic-looking worlds. This is opposed to the film camera, which records the real world. The camera simply captures data that can be read back in a controlled way. The images are sequenced on a strip of celluloid, controlled by a sprocket drive and a motor. It is essentially a storage medium with a display, yet it is nonlinear. Images can be rearranged at any point in the time sequence of the stored data of film. We call this film editing, and for years that was how I made my living. Historically, the very first projected images were lantern slides painted by artists. Now we are returning to the artists controlling the images with their hands. They are once again painting in movies, except this time it is from a digital paint box. How ironic that this technology should return us to our beginnings with moving images, yet those wonderful people out there in the dark, as Norma Desmond referred to them, they haven't changed. They still want the emotional stories that I saw depicted above the fireplace at the ranch in Peach Crop. The Distraction. When it came time to restore the original Star Wars and re-release it, 1997, George called a few people together in the Building C Theater, and we screened his personal print. Traditionally, only one or two prints like George's would be made off the original negative of any major movie. The first was called the Answer print. People called timers would grade the brightness and color quality, making corrections based on tests and experience, and get their answer with this first print. This was also the first time picture and sound were married on one strip of film ready for projection. The director and cinematographer would watch this print and make whatever additional corrections they wanted. If this was deemed good, the second answer print would be kept as theoretically the best and most original example of the movie. It would certainly be the sharpest, as it was made directly off the original camera negative. Many duplicate negatives would now be made off the original for mass printings that would reach theaters around the world. As the film rolled in Theater C, George made comments on the scenes he wanted to fix or, in some cases, add. From his perspective, these changes were all based on what he wanted to do in the first place, but had either run out of time, technology, or money on the first go-around. Now that he had all three at his disposal, he wanted to get it exactly as he originally envisioned it. One of the things very few directors ever got to do was make preservation masters of their films after they were completed, as it was expensive and no one wanted to pay for it, least of all the studio. But some people had enough clout and they got it done. The original negatives were protected because they were really only used to make dupe negatives, and those dupes are the ones that take the abuse. But there was another problem. The original negatives are subject to color fading and physical shrinkage over long periods of time. Star Wars was an important film and a valuable studio property, so it got the full treatment with the process called separation masters. Three black and white copies of the original negative are made, each filtered for either red, green, or blue. Since black and white film is essentially inert, unlike color film, which remains chemically active and subject to deterioration, long-term storage of these three strips were to provide a measure of protection, especially since they were going to be stored at the bottom of a salt mine in Nevada or somewhere. After George pointed out all of the shots he wanted fixed, he said something I have wondered about ever since. He said that he was going to do a comedy version of Star Wars. It's been years since that day, and it hasn't happened yet, but remember, you heard it here first. When I got back to my office, I wrote George an email saying that I thought a film should be made that documented all the people that worked on the original movie. They were all still alive, and many of them still worked for him. Surely they had great stories that shouldn't be lost forever. I reminded him that he had seen the documentary I made on the making of Jurassic Park, and that he liked it well enough to call up my boss and tell him so. The next day my phone rang, and it was George's attorney. He told me that George liked my idea, and that he, Howard Rothman, would be in charge of the project. I never heard from him again. About a month later, I wrote George again and said that I guessed no one except he and I were interested in doing this project. In a few days, I got a call from Lynn Hale, the head of publicity, informing me that there was going to be a documentary, but that it would be handled by the studio. I've never seen it. Recently, I talked to my friend and fellow editor Tom Christopher, who George had hired to handle all the film and lab details of what he wanted done to the original Star Wars. Tom said he remembered my letter coming in because George's longtime producer, Rick McCallum, wanted to know, who the hell is this guy? None of the Lucasfilm executives wanted George fooling around with his old movies. It's a distraction, they said. We are not in the restoration business. The new movies were where the big money was. Lucasfilm's licensing was going nuts, signing up sponsors and endless tie-ins. If George would commit to make 3 more Star Wars sequels, there was no limit to the money that could be made. Sales, marketing, legal, they all conspired to put on a huge show at the ranch, to which they invited all the suitor toy, game, studio, and brand folks from around the world. Hundreds of millions of dollars in advance money was at stake, not to mention the billions of dollars that would almost certainly flow from these deals if only the old man, the crazy grandfather they had metaphorically locked in the attic of the main house, wasn't stirring up shit, wandering around in his bathrobe, so to speak, laying out plans and giving orders that were not in line with the juggernaut business plan of the century that Business Affairs was about to launch. This was a potential disaster. He owned the company outright. It was a billion-dollar enterprise, but it was not a public company like Apple, where the executives could execute a coup and overnight throw out a Steve Jobs. They had to be careful. And here I show up with even wilder ideas about doing a historical documentary. Who is this guy, indeed? I was seen immediately as a co-conspirator and should, like Howard Beale in the movie Network, have been given the same famous film speech he got. You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale. There is only one holistic system of systems, one vast and immense interwoven, interacting, multivariant, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichsmarks, rins, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today. That is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today. And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature, and you will atone. All was not well in the Empire by about 1996 or so. The ancillary money stream from toy deals that George had so famously bargained for with the original Star Wars had dwindled. The bonanza of home video sales had also dissipated. The lifetime annuity of cash that arrived to help smooth the balance sheets was now but a trickle. ILM was the bright spot. It was profitable most years, but the rest of the divisions were, for the most part, losing money. There had been the disappointment in the failure of Howard the Duck, along with a string of productions that made some money, but not really enough to keep the whole studio afloat for years. Willow, Labyrinth, The Return of Oz, Mishima, the young Indiana Jones television series, all did not have the blockbuster strength needed to make sense as a business plan that could underwrite the entire company like Star Wars had. The original idea was sound. Make your money on the big picture releases every few years, and try to just break even during the intervening years. But when blockbusters are removed from that scenario, you are in trouble. So what to do? If you are a rock and roll band, you go back on the road. If you are the ex-heavyweight champion, you return to the ring for one more big payday. There was really no other choice. I had walked into the middle of this scenario without knowing what was going on behind the scenes, and I would have to atone. This reminded me of the time after I had first had my encounter with Francis Coppola, and I thought it would be a good idea to either write an article about him or just interview him. Maybe I could sell the interview to a magazine. So I wrote to his company, American Zoetrope, and made a proposal for an interview for Playboy magazine. They liked the idea but needed a letter from Playboy confirming it. So I wrote to Playboy, laying out my argument for such an interview by saying that Coppola was a young, hip, Oscar-winning filmmaker who had founded his own company in San Francisco. They also liked the idea, but thought it was a little too early. Let's keep our eye on him and see what develops, they wrote me. About a year after The Godfather was released and became the highest-grossing motion picture of all time, I wrote Playboy again and reminded them of my Coppola interview project. This time they wrote back in a much firmer tone, "When people go to see a film because it is a Francis Coppola film, then we would consider him for a Playboy interview." I didn't know what to make of that. However, it seemed clear they were not going to consider my interview choice, so I moved on. In July 1975, I was at a newsstand, and the cover of Playboy had this headline: "Big Hitman Talks. Playboy Grills Godfather Director Francis Ford Coppola." I didn't see my name there anywhere. The Star Wars original negative was in the studio vault in Los Angeles, but there were elements important to a restoration that came from the mine shaft. With something this important, more than one location is a prudent way to ensure a backup master would survive. The original plan was to only redo the wipes, those famously old-fashioned Star Wars transitions that literally wiped one image off the screen while bringing on the next one in an optical trick used in the old movie serials. George never liked how they looked, and he wanted them redone. While unofficially no one wanted this restoration to happen, they couldn't really come right out and say that, but, like Congress, they could subtly defy the president's wishes by not funding it. There was a standoff for a while. George kept ordering stuff and adding to the shots he wanted fixed. For our part, ILM opened a project billing account and started charging all our time to it. Not much the executives at the ranch could do about that. Ironically, the ranch was a little different. That was the executives' domain, and it was under their control. So they formed a committee to oversee the restoration project, told Tom Christopher to attend, and started giving orders to mute the whole thing. But they had a problem. George asked to meet with Tom every Friday and give him a report on how things were going on the restoration. Very few people met with George on a regular basis. The power had now shifted. Tom is a very smart, detail-oriented guy. He doesn't play politics or suffer fools gladly. He didn't argue or plead his case. He didn't threaten or pull a George said. He just went back to the committee and simply said, "I need you to issue 3 purchase orders, and I will bill everything I need to them." Game over. The purchase orders were issued, and the original Star Wars was going to get some updates and a restoration. Tom set up a command center editing room at the ranch and hired assistants. He found the original negative at Fox and the separation masters in a salt mine somewhere in the Midwest. But he couldn't find the original negatives for the wipes. They looked all over Los Angeles. No luck. Nobody asked me. They were in my ILM editorial warehouse. This illustrates one of the strange things about working for a large company. Information is valuable, it is power, and no one wants to give it up. Lucasfilm was a collection of fiefdoms, and all information was held strictly inside those fiefdoms. No one would tell you anything they didn't absolutely have to. Tom knew this and decided to do the exact opposite. He told his assistants that if anyone called with any questions, they were to answer them as best they could, and he did the same himself. Slowly, over time, this meant that Tom became the go-to guy for the entire company. Since everyone was in the dark, even the top executives, this meant that they could have their secretaries call Tom's editing room and ask, for instance, where George was. There was no downside in calling Tom because he was just an editor. Calling George's assistant and major gatekeeper, Jane Bay, would be noted. The question of why they wanted to know might be asked. No, it was best to just call Tom. Finally, someone called me about the missing wipe originals, and I said, "Let's have a look in our warehouse." I, too, had the answer-all-questions policy. I'd learned that from Karen, the receptionist. Tom was a freelancer, not on staff, so it took him a while to find me. We had the negative and everything else he was looking for. Everything should have been easy in restoring Star Wars, because the studio had made Technicolor dye separation masters. This was the classic method of making color movies from black and white negatives by dyeing prints from each of the 3 negatives with either red, green, or blue. Gone with the Wind was shot in Technicolor by an enormous camera that exposed 3 black-and-white negatives in camera at once with these primary colors. Star Wars had been shot with the later standard color negative made by Eastman Kodak. But to preserve the film, the Technicolor 3-strip method was used because, while Eastman negatives would deteriorate with shrinkage and fading colors, the Technicolor method would not. You just made new color prints off the bulletproof black-and-white masters. This Technicolor process had a backstory that I discovered one day while wandering around San Rafael in my lunch hour. It's a little side note to the story of the restoration and the Technicolor elements that were used to preserve Star Wars. But it is typical of how things evolve in Hollywood. It turns out that in 1918, the first feature-length color motion picture was shot in San Rafael, the same city where I worked at ILM, by a man named Leon Douglas. I first learned about him while visiting a downtown area of old Marin mansions where he lived. Mr. Douglas was a very wealthy man who had co-founded the Victor Talking Machine Company, famous for its ads that featured a dog looking into the horn of a Victrola with the line, "His Master's Voice." The Victrola was a wind-up record player, and Douglas's version of a phonograph. He named his invention after his wife, Victoria. After Douglas encased the player in a fine furniture cabinet so ladies would allow it in their living rooms, it became universally popular, and he sold millions of them. He sold so many of them that he had to hire 7,000 cabinet makers just to keep up with the demand. Douglas was also a prolific inventor who held over 50 patents. For motion pictures, he patented a zoom lens, the first anamorphic lens, a special effects camera which he rented to Hollywood studios, and his color film process. It was here in Marin where he produced the first American feature-length color film, starring Ruth Roland with Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks making guest appearances. When Douglas took his color process to all the major studios to demonstrate it, no one was interested. Yet by the 1930s, color motion pictures were being made using the Technicolor process, which was based on Douglas's inventions, and all the studios were distributing them. Douglas sued to enforce his patents and won a $20 million settlement in 1934. He won by default when the defendants, Paramount Pictures, Fox Film Corporation, Disney, and Technicolor, failed to respond to the suit. Needless to say, $20 million was a lot of money in 1934, arguably the bottom of the Great Depression. Still, Hollywood would often rather just buy technology than invest in its development. In the late 1970s, when the protection masters of Star Wars, the highest-grossing movie of all time, were made by what was now 20th Century Fox and the Douglas-inspired Technicolor, they did it on the cheap. There are two ways to make these masters, wet or dry. Either way is expensive, but the wet printing method is more expensive. Essentially, the negative image from the original is rephotographed through a special liquid that makes any scratches and some dirt not register on the copy negative. The liquid fills up the scratch, thus letting the projector light pass straight through the film and not catch in the groove of the scratch, revealing a blemish. Someone chose the cheaper alternative, and we were paying for that now. Eventually, Tom got all of the technical challenges met by looking up some of the older lab employees from the golden era of motion picture labs. Upon their advice, he had the various negatives rewashed or reprinted using the wet gate method, all the while finding various pieces that had gone missing from this giant puzzle. Soon all was ready to cut into the original Star Wars negative. Before doing that, however, Tom wanted to check something with George. He explained to George that everything was ready to cut in, but he wanted to know whether they should order a duplicate negative of the original version. It could easily be done, he said, and then there would always be an original version of this historic movie. George said, "This is the original version," meaning that what everyone else had described as a restoration, he considered the final version of the movie. This brings up an interesting point. Who should decide these things? Should the public have any say in what happens to a work of art or a national treasure? After paying almost $200 million for a famous Van Gogh, should the owner object if Van Gogh himself showed up and said, "I always wanted to add more blue to this, but I couldn't afford it back then. Mind if I add it now?" Are there cultural treasures that are so important that they shouldn't be changed even by the artists that created them? Franz Kafka wanted all of his writings burned after his death. Fortunately for posterity, they were not. Is the quality or historical value of a work of art more meaningful than the wishes of its author? Should Harper Lee have been allowed to publish Go Set a Watchman, turning her heroic main character in To Kill a Mockingbird, beloved by millions, into a racist? As we advance into the digital world of the future, where undetectable changes can be made with increasing sophistication, this question will, I think, be asked again and again. The original Star Wars was re-released in 1997 as The Special Edition, and it skyrocketed to the number one position at the box office for 3 weeks, grossing over $138 million. This surprised a lot of people, even George, I suspect. Empire and Jedi soon followed, all of them together grossing more than $250 million. These unwanted re-releases helped build a cash pile that could fund the new Star Wars films that would ultimately generate billions of dollars in new revenue. George was back in the game. Digital City. For some time, it had become apparent that ILM had outgrown its location in Marin County, and once again the impracticality of the ranch came up. There was certainly enough room to expand the ranch to include ILM, but there were other problems. George had already developed an adjoining property he owned called Big Rock Ranch, but it made his neighbors unhappy, and although he later got permission from the county to build a production facility on even another ranch he owned, he wisely decided to not force it. So around 1999, when it came time to make a big proposal to move ILM to the Presidio in San Francisco, we made a pitch to both the board that controls the Presidio and its well-heeled neighbors. The old Presidio Army base is surrounded by some of the most expensive residential real estate in the country. These neighbors had connections to politics and business, so they needed to be reassured. This move also was tantamount to admitting that the ranch was not where all the new young talent wanted to be. The digital artists that needed to be continuously recruited had no interest in living in Lucasland or anywhere else but San Francisco. Even Silicon Valley would later have to make serious concessions, offering high-class buses to and from the city in order to be competitive in attracting talent. George wanted to make a short film explaining why everyone should approve his building a series of structures on the old Letterman Army Hospital site on the Presidio grounds and moving a large part of his company there. They even recruited me to work on this film project. In our first meeting, the director and cinematographer, Bob Dalva, explained that he wanted to open the film with a montage of antique projection devices, culminating in a modern one. The proposed buildings were sited in such a way that they looked right down at the Palace of Fine Arts, a building designed by the famous local architect Bernard Maybach. This beloved building was the only remnant of the 1915 Panama Pacific Exposition, which celebrated not only the opening of the West via the new Panama Canal, but also the introduction of electric lighting and the first transatlantic telephone call, which was the last link to connecting the world. So I suggested that we use some of the spectacular public domain footage of this fair as well. It showed an entire city of exposition buildings, all lit with thousands of early electric lights. It was a magical-looking city, covered with reflective globes that doubled the power of the lights and searchlights that continuously swept the skies. This area of the Marina District had been largely reclaimed bay marsh, and it was built on fill. Importantly, the fill used was the rubble from the old San Francisco that had collapsed in 1906. By implication, we would be pointing to a rebirth of the city, whose digital future would repeat this famous analog opening of a canal. In other words, approve our proposal and help make San Francisco the center of the digital world, a world that Marshall McLuhan had presaged as a global village. Director Dalva shouted this idea down so forcefully that I just dropped it. It was as if I had suggested something that was uncinematic. Bob had a long history with both Lucas and Coppola and was a noted cinematographer-editor, so there was no point in arguing. My next idea was accepted but with incredulity. I said, if you want to film some old movie projectors, I have a friend that has an amazing collection of them, and she works right here at ILM. Sandra Joy Lee was our media librarian. She was whip-smart, very congenial, and, as a hobby, she collected old movie projectors from the earliest zoetropes to beautiful, almost deco-looking mid-1930s projectors. She also donated her time working as a projectionist at the local art house movie theater that Marcia Lucas had donated money to restore. This was the same theater to which I had ridden my bike from my Aunt Bobbitt's apartment as a child. Sandra was yet another example of the amazing talent ILM had brought together. What other young woman is there that just so happens to collect and operate antique motion picture equipment? Sandra's library department had absorbed my old video movie collection from the editorial department, and she had lined the archive walls with displays of her great old projectors. This was an idea that could not be just dismissed out of hand. So when I dropped by Sandra's library a few days later, Dalva had the whole place lit like a movie set, and Sandra was beaming that her collection was being used to help us get awarded the coveted acreage on an invaluable site in the Presidio. I thought a lot about this proposed Letterman Digital Art Center, and I was strongly in favor of it because I thought it made perfect sense, both historically and for the future of San Francisco. I told one of the Presidio neighbors that I didn't have a dog in this fight. I just worked for the guy. But I thought people would be crazy to turn it down, especially if you consider the quality of workmanship Lucas is known for. He was proposing an underground parking garage for all employee vehicles and had hired the foremost landscape architect in the country, Lawrence Halprin, to design a park with a creek spilling into a beautiful pond to cover the garage. Plus, this would be open to the public. Mothers with baby carriages and young children will be strolling here for decades to come. In order to speak to the center's historical importance, I wrote a paper on the subject and sent it to the screenwriter for the film project, Matthew Robbins, an old friend of George's. The final documentary included at least some of my thoughts, and eventually the plan to build the Letterman Digital Arts Center was approved. Today, San Francisco is awash with a tidal wave of digital success as new ventures are introduced weekly. The Stone Age Institute. Security at ILM was always high for several reasons. One was to keep out the curious fans who were sometimes determined to find souvenirs or meet movie stars who were occasionally there. The biggest reason, however, was more industry protocol than anything else. We were always working on several movies at a time, and each Hollywood studio expected us to protect the privacy of their intellectual property in scripts and the proprietary techniques we were using on their projects. The last thing anyone wanted was for some director or producer to divulge at a cocktail party what he or she had seen of another person's film. Since most film projects took well over a year to complete, there was a natural desire not to reveal spoilers about anyone's upcoming release. Why endanger the surprise when it's part of what the audience is looking for? Sometimes, however, if things were slow enough, I could get permission to bring a few people in and show them around. As my interest in paleoanthropology widened, I was invited to join the advisory board of the Stone Age Institute in Bloomington, Indiana. Funded largely by Gordon Getty, the son and heir of oil tycoon J. Paul Getty, the Institute fields anthropologists for worldwide expeditions to sites where early man lived, bringing back human skulls, skeletons, and tools for study and scholarly presentations. They were studying the family of man, and I was studying my family. So I took the founders of the Institute, Nick Toth and Kathy Schick, along with its vice president, Henry Corning, who, with Getty, is the chief financial engineer for the Institute, through ILM and then to the ranch for lunch. It turned out that Henry was so impressed with the atmosphere at the ranch that he organized the building of a similar country complex for their institute, which gave Nick and Kathy some independence from the University of Indiana and their own stature as more than just employee professors. The Institute is now a multi-million-dollar complex on about 40 acres of farmland outside Bloomington. It is a gorgeous compound built of Indiana limestone with a great hall that features, instead of the typical busts of Plato, Socrates, and other monumental intellectual leaders, all of the important skulls of our ancient ancestors, such as Java Man, etc. When I first saw the new place, I remembered something Lucas had said after donating hundreds of millions of dollars to USC for a new film school building. If you want a discipline to be taken seriously, you need a serious building. The Stone Age Institute now had a serious building. Man is a toolmaker, and Nick invites all kinds of people who use tools in their craft to lecture and visit the Institute. Thus my invitation. Anthropologists learn about early man by studying his behavior and trying to reproduce his skills. The modern-day making of a stone tool is the ultimate learning experience. Nick showed me how to make what are called hand axes and gave me one. It's funny, but they look and fit the hand just like a computer mouse. The best examples for learning about early man are modern humans themselves. After all, as Phil Tippett, one of the geniuses behind Jurassic Park, taught me, existing animals are the best paleontological record we have of what the ancient ones might have been like. Since we are a type of animal ourselves, it makes sense to study ourselves in all our forms. Michel de Montaigne's essays famously record his study of himself. He wrote that he used some traits of my character to describe the traits of man, as in, I have never seen a greater monster or miracle than myself. This involvement with the Institute began my limited but eventful introduction to Gordon Getty. Nick called me one day and asked if I could come to Bloomington again for a convocation they were having. I was torn as to whether I could spend the time away from my own work in starting my distribution business, but when he mentioned that Gordon was flying out in his private jet and that I would be welcome to join him, that cinched it. I can imagine no comparison in jet travel, save possibly flying with a member of the Saudi royal family. Gordon and his wife had spent millions redesigning and redecorating this 727 airliner. They had chosen it because Gordon was 6'5", and it was the only plane that he could stand up in comfortably. But it was not so much the luxury at play here as the simple comfort and convenience of having a personal plane of this type. All things considered, Gordon is a fairly modest man. Having engineered the sale of his family's oil company in 1984 for $10 billion, he is well acquainted with extreme wealth, so much so that on having heard that Gordon had lost $50 million in a business venture, I asked Henry about it, since they were old friends going back to their Harvard days, and he said something I will never forget. These things happen. That type of thinking is so far from the average person's experience, it reminds one of the famous F. Scott Fitzgerald quote, "Let me tell you about the very rich. They are different from you and me." Well, this was a different way of travel. As I pulled up to the private plane terminal at Oakland International Airport, someone came and got my bags from the car. From there, I walked out onto the tarmac and scurried up the rear steps of the 727, affectionately named Jetty by Gordon's kids. Fore and aft were large areas, with a few huge cushioned swivel chairs sprinkled about, the type you might find in an executive office, except permanently attached to the floor. There were also some couches and huge video screens showing our flight path, with animation as well as weather data. These screens, fore and aft, were also used to play in-flight movies or television shows. In the center of the plane was Gordon's bedroom, with a huge double bed and private bath. The kitchen was next to this towards the front of the plane. There was a crew of five: captain, co-pilot, navigator, and two stewardesses. Breakfast featured fresh fruit, all kinds of juices and coffees, and the choice of two kinds of omelets. Unlike commercial flights, there was no security check, and the door to the cockpit remained open, which meant I could talk to the pilot. I asked him if this was a dream job, and he said that the best thing for him was that while the plane had all the fancy autopilot stuff, you could still fly it manually, and because of its low weight due to so few passengers, one time it was just four people, it was a real hot rod. I can attest to this, as takeoffs were at a very sharp angle up. I asked one of the crew where I should sit, as Gordon's limo hadn't arrived yet. "Anywhere but that chair," he said, pointing to one of the big swivels. "That's Mr. G's chair." So I sat on a couch. When Gordon arrived, he introduced himself while the crew slammed the interior cabinet doors. He never did sit in that chair, but there was no time to ponder it, as we were almost immediately airborne. Very efficient. Gordon was deep into writing on a yellow legal-size pad, so I poked around, noting every major newspaper and magazine either neatly folded or displayed for use. When we landed at the regional airport in Bloomington, I was told our plane was the largest one to ever land there. Gordon may be a billionaire, but he dresses like a college professor, with a saggy sport jacket, cheap wristwatch, an old wallet, all of which he laughs about. If it was about convenience or art, he was interested, but petty jewelry or trinkets like cars are of little use to him. For years, he drove an AMC Pacer and still talks about it fondly. When the conference was over, I flew with Gordon to New York, where I'd planned my own vacation before flying back home on a commercial flight. Landing at a private airport in New Jersey, we were still the largest plane by far. Gordon's jetliner dwarfed the puny little Learjets and Gulfstreams that all the Wall Street hotshots had squeezed into. I hitched a ride in Gordon's limo to Manhattan, and he told me of his longtime desire to produce a movie of Wagner's Ring, but had been told it would cost $1 billion. When he dropped me at my cheap New York hotel, I mentioned that I would be willing to produce the ring for $600 million tops. I'm not sure if he knew I was joking or not. I had now been turned back into a pumpkin and was no longer consorting with billionaires. Gordon was staying at New York's Palace Hotel, and I was staying at The Pod. Mine was a wonderful European-style budget hotel, just not in league with New York's finest. My wife met me in Manhattan, and after touring the city, I suggested we drop the return airline tickets we had planned on using and drive back in a rental car that we could leave in San Francisco. Neither of us had done a cross-country drive since just after college. I vowed to take back roads whenever possible and not to eat in any chain restaurants during the entire trip. It took a month, and we had a ball. Dropping dead. The last line in the opening to Orson Welles' masterpiece, Citizen Kane, is, "Then last week, as it must to all men, death came to Charles Foster Kane." Mine came on a Friday afternoon in 2002. It was not like I wasn't expecting it. They had just awarded me with a golden statue of the Star Wars character, C-3PO, to mark my 20 years. The first day of my employment, I had signed in with the receptionist, and when I walked past her, she said just loud enough for me to hear, "Day one." It was now day 7,300 and counting. I was like the man who came to dinner and never left. It was originally supposed to be about an 8-month gig, but the films just kept coming. I was the chief visual effects editor and was promoted to department head, which included our commercial division. Department heads traditionally didn't last very long, but I lasted 9 years, which was a record. I survived 4 management changes and numerous political battles, but when the digital revolution hit with full force, my age began to cripple me. The company pretty much split into film versus digital. This was about the time when George announced to no one in particular that editing on film was like scratching on rocks. I became a Neanderthal. Although I spent all day on an avid digital editing machine, it didn't matter. I had been using computers for writing since before hard drives. I had been on the Internet at home since about 1989 and had websites up in 1999. None of this mattered. I was the old guy in editorial. I became the union steward, and Patty, the head of production, said, apropos of nothing, "That won't do you any good." Allies disappeared. I asked to see my personnel file, and in it was a statement from Kim, a producer and sometimes friend, that said, "He is an old man and should probably retire." Fortunately, I had already started preparations to retire, once again following the advice of Montaigne. Retire into yourself, but first prepare yourself to be your own host. In December 1999 and January 2000, I had sold all the stock in my retirement account. This meant that I completely avoided the tech wreck that cost the equity markets a loss of $5 trillion. There is a Hollywood tale that Harry Cohn once ordered the writer of Citizen Kane, Herman J. Mankiewicz, off the Columbia studio lot, ending his tirade with, "And don't bring him back, ever, unless we need him." On Friday, August 2, 2002, I walked out the door. I was back on the following Monday because they needed me. But it was a brief reprieve, and I decided to retire anyway. Still, it was a shock. I had worked for over 30 years. Was I ready for this? In 1919, Jess Willard, who had defeated Jack Johnson in Havana, Cuba, fought the much-feared Jack Dempsey to defend his heavyweight title. Dempsey knocked Willard down 7 times in the first round, going on to win in round 4 when Willard could not continue. Someone later asked Willard what he was thinking as he was being knocked down so many times, and he replied, "I kept saying to myself, I have $100,000 and a ranch in Kansas. I have $100,000 and a ranch in Kansas." Was there something I could say to myself? I did have a small ranch in the wine country, besides my home in Berkeley, so I told myself that since I knew who I was now, I could have a life rich in writing, real estate investing, and distributing my own movies. I love the city with its cafes and bookstores, but I also need to be in nature every so often. I find the contrast in going from one to the other immensely refreshing. Each in its own way rejuvenates my spirits, and I feel fortunate to have this option. I bought the country place as a retreat for my high-stress job and city life in general. It is on a small hill, overlooking what has become a wine region. The property contains a Sea Ranch-style house built out of clear heart redwood, a separate studio building, and a small cottage-like structure with its own deck that I use for writing. There are also lots of acres to roam around on. I can run my small businesses from there or the city, but I also try to have fun wherever I am. Most of my friends, who had also left Lucasfilm, trotted off to other jobs, both in and out of the film business. I didn't feel the need anymore. I was finally ready for my close-up. Oddly enough, one of the things I did after I retired was to buy a slot machine. If there is a more clear parallel to the gamble so familiar to the movie maker, I don't know what it would be. It's like a horoscope for real, but with no phony promises. You know you cannot win, only delay the inevitable. It's a gentle reminder of the idiot's tale we are all involved in. Mine is one of those old-style quarter machines with a $150 jackpot. It came out of Harvey's Wagon Wheel Casino in Reno, Nevada, and is of about a 1958 vintage. I think I got it just because I could never play one when my mother occasionally took us to Reno as kids. The casinos were fascinating to me back then. Not only were the rooms full of gambling devices, with bells ringing and coins crashing into payout bins, but there were also memorable displays. One casino had a museum-like room lined with artifacts from the Old West, like antique rifles, pistols, and derringers, just like I saw in the movies and on television. Another had a large glass case with $1 million in cash on display. Cowboys and money. It doesn't get any better than that for a kid raised on westerns. Personally, I can't understand why anyone would want to play the new slots that have no coins and only pay out a little slip of paper. What fun is that? Even hitting a small jackpot on mine brings a neurotransmitter cocktail of pleasure to your brain, with its crash of quarters clanging into the metal tray. That sound, like a great movie moment, was carefully designed to pick up your spirits so you would play again. Here I am, unemployed for the first time in 32 years, and I buy a slot machine. But that wasn't all. I bought a 1947 Lionel train set, exactly like the one I lost in the chaos after my mother's death. I, like a lot of people, have a somewhat romanticized view of life. Yet what is more appropriate? Does anyone really desire the real version? At my small ranch, my aunt's old summer resort, and Grandpa's booze truck, the REO Speedwagon, are still within 6 miles of me. They say you can't go home again. Well, we shall see about that. After buying the slot, I took it to a guy in San Mateo, south of San Francisco, for a tune-up. Steve Squires had been working on slot machines since he was 17 years old, and he was then 76. This guy was amazing, and his shop was filled with antique slot machines. They were everywhere, covering almost every square foot of floor space to the extent that only footpaths were left open for navigation. The walls were hung with old slot machine faceplates like mine, from every brand and year imaginable. From the ceiling hung hundreds of old slot wheels, each with varying combinations of cherries, oranges, and plums brightly printed on them. There was room after room filled with boxes, drawers, and shelves, all overflowing with antique parts. Steve told me that Lucasfilm had once asked him to rig a slot machine for a movie, so that every time the handle was pulled, there would be a jackpot. That would save a lot of time in shooting a scene. He couldn't remember the movie, and my best guess was Tucker, the Man and His Dream. One thing I always wondered about was how they set the odds on a slot. I asked Steve, and he said, you can't do it mechanically, which is what everyone thinks. You have to change the order and frequency of the cherries and other fruit images that appear on a given reel. It turns out that three-reel machines have about 8,000 possible combinations of images that might appear on the payline. Alter the makeup of the reels, and you change the odds. A machine like mine could potentially earn the casino about $800 a day. 100 working machines would pay for a lot of casino overhead back in the 1950s. The jackpot, too, was a decent payout when you consider you could buy a used car for $150 back then. I think of my 25-cent machine as representative of the movie world's resistance to change. I don't want to play the new electronic slots. And Thomas Edison originally didn't want to project his images. He preferred to sell his kinetoscopes for private viewing in commercial parlors, which charged 25 cents to watch a few film clips. If we put out a screen machine, projector, he said, there will be a use for maybe about 10 of them in the whole United States. Let's not kill the goose that lays the golden egg. My 25-cent machine is still an unkilled goose. Edison didn't want to give up those quarters, and I don't want to submit to the electronic when the mechanical is more fun. I sometimes complain about the lack of technological progress in the world, yet sometimes celebrate it, and I'm not alone. We all edit our lives to some extent. We pick and choose. Many people who drive modern cars and use the latest cell phones still want to live in Victorian houses. When I got the slot machine home, I wondered whether I should just not tell the wife and take it to Boonville on my next trip, or get it over with right now. I opened the lift back and dropped the tailgate to my SUV, invited her out, and handed her a quarter. She pulled the handle, hit three cherries, scooped up the jackpot, and disappeared back into the house saying, "That was fun." I never had a problem after that, and we both occasionally pull the handle when we are in the country. Steve had warned me to play it often. They like that. There is something about pulling that handle and going through this little exercise of anticipation, suspense, and surprise, but I can't quite put my finger on it. I wish I could ask Montaigne what he thought. My machine had come out of Harvey's Wagon Wheel Casino. which had been started by a former butcher named Harvey Gross. He and his wife ran a popular lunch counter with a few slots back in the 1940s. With that start, they grew it into a large casino enterprise that cleared them about $1 million a year by the 1950s. Investor types kept pleading with him to expand throughout Nevada. He always gave the same answer. With $1 million a year, we are doing fine. After all, how many steaks can you eat? Here was another story that I could use somewhere. Maybe after my distribution business runs out of gas. But it doesn't ever seem to. Even though at $25, our movie is not cheap. Last Christmas alone, I mailed over 500 DVDs of American Nitro from Boonville in about 3 days, overwhelming the local post office. I don't have to wait for a royalty statement and a check from a publisher to know how I'm doing. Besides, it's more of a hobby anyway. That and my effort to keep the work alive for as long as I can. Next up to restore and distribute will be my old Jack Johnson movie. This distribution thing all came about through a somewhat strange set of circumstances. It isn't supposed to happen. Creative people do their work and depend on a company that specializes in distribution to handle that for a fee. A large fee. And for that fee, the publisher is supposed to do advertising and promotion for their authors. This rarely works out well for the writers and filmmakers. Unfortunately, there is no alternative to this for most people. But there have always been exceptions. Mark Twain did not do what his contemporaneous authors did. Twain published his own books and sold them door-to-door, hiring agents for this arduous task. His methods were far outside the conventional book publishing trade. This just wasn't done by serious authors. It smacked of vanity publishing, or cheap, low-class books, except that this was also the way that the Bible was sold, door-to-door. Twain was very successful at this because he could laugh at any vanity publishing charge. He was Mark Twain. His biggest success using this method was in publishing the memoirs of General Ulysses S. Grant, which I have mentioned before. It was one of the largest publishing successes in American history. Twain sold more of these books than anything except the Bible, and it brought Grant's family over $500,000 in royalties, a fortune in the 1880s. I reread the memoirs myself every few years. In 2002, I decided to follow the Mark Twain route and distribute my own movie. Like George Lucas, I felt that now no one could tell that I was too old or uncool to make movies. I was retired and was done working on other people's projects. Besides the country house, I had a home in Berkeley, some real estate investment property, and a steady income from several sources. As Montaigne had recommended, I had prepared to be my own host. At some point, I discovered that the movie my brother and I had made, American Nitro, was being talked about in certain internet chat groups. Long out of distribution, it had become a kind of cult film. This and the circus-like atmosphere of the whole thing made the movie a viable commercial entity and a historical document. One of the people in the film section at the Library of Congress told us that your movie is pure Americana and will only get more and more interesting as time passes. That was enough for me. We pulled the original 35mm negative out of storage and had it transferred to a digital format of the highest quality available. That's the great thing about motion picture negatives. They are of such high quality that you can keep going back to them again and again as current technologies improve. In fact, a couple of years ago, I sold some of our footage to a Hollywood studio that was making a feature film on two of the characters in our movie for $100 a second. I toyed with the idea of changing the movie, at least to the extent of trying to set it up for the non-racing fan. There was a Roman quote about bread and circuses that I tried out, but nothing seemed to improve it, so I decided to leave it as it was originally. The only thing we added was a director's commentary where my brother and I gave our thoughts on where the movie came from and what we had tried to do. It was a drive-in picture, and almost everyone saw it as just a drag race documentary, which it was. But if you thought about it for a minute, who in the hell would make a drag race documentary like this? It didn't hype its subject. It exposed it as a strange and somewhat hidden subculture, an outlaw sport, which neither drag race officialdom nor the reviewers much appreciated. There were a few people who got it, however. On the high end, it was seen as asphalt anthropology, and on the low, I watched it every night for a year. Just ask my wife. That's a real fan quote, and as a friend of mine pointed out, that should read ex-wife. Looking back, it seems that the art movement of the 1970s went through a kind of metamorphosis from abstraction to realism, or at least some of it did. And this was felt in filmmaking and still photography as well. I think of our movie as contemporary realism. Other examples are the movie Derby, a documentary on the fringe sport of roller derby, and the book Suburbia by Bill Owens, whose black-and-white still photos chronicle the early 1970s suburban lifestyles of Americans. I'm sure I would be hard-pressed to find any art critic to agree with me, but I really don't care. They will get to it eventually. For now, Nitro has well over 800,000 fans on Facebook. I looked up the ranking of our page once, and at that time we were ahead of Johnny Depp, the Los Angeles Lakers, Bonnie Raitt, Starbucks, the iPhone 6, and Patsy Cline. It's hard to find a male, and a surprising number of females, between the ages of 30 and 70 that does not have fond memories of hot rod cars in high school, or their father taking them to the races, or going racing themselves with their buddies. It was endemic to the culture, and we had attempted to chronicle this wide segment of the population. These are the guys we send to fight our wars. They drive the long-haul trucks, snowplows, and heavy equipment. They go hunting and fishing. They like guns and motorcycles and hot rod custom cars of one kind or another. They are religious and they are patriotic. They are the first to feel some of the harshest blows due to high gasoline prices, moving jobs overseas, technological change, or economic downturns. So in an effort to find that audience and engage with them, I created a social media page on Facebook for fans of American Nitro. But not just the movie. I wanted it to represent the zeitgeist of this particular part of our culture as well. Since I am not a participant in this world, I can only be an observer and commentator. This makes the site an extension of the movie in a way. Yet I have never heard of anyone else doing something like this before. Sometimes it seems more like a kind of performance piece. However, if the artist Cindy Sherman can dress up as stereotypical characters from everyday life and then photograph herself as her art, I guess I can communicate with my group through role-playing. When I started, I was only able to attract a handful of people. But as I learned how to appeal to them, it soon started to grow. We currently have a very large number of fans on the site. Many of them have purchased the movie from us, and many more will in time. People hear about the movie from the Facebook page, watch the trailers either there or on YouTube, and order it through our website using PayPal. This means we don't have to do any billing, as PayPal collects the money and deposits it in our bank before we ship the DVDs. For the computer phobic, we accept checks, and there must be some kind of economic law here or something because we've never had a return check in 8 years. Apparently, people don't bounce checks for their hobbies. They may short the grocer or the landlord, but not the discretionary items that they really don't need. Or do they? Perhaps we are just more passionate about our hobbies. Many have commented that our website is eye candy, or even car porn for them. So far, I have been flying completely under the radar of the studio system, hoping to remain undetected. One thing is for sure. I've gotten to know how the fans think, as this is a window into their lives. I see pictures of their children and their homes, as well as the parents and grandparents. I know where they live and what they do, and can predict how they will react to most things. Their voting for Trump was one of those things. Politics aside, it is a fascinating group that is easy to like. As best as I can describe it, we are continuing the dialogue with the audience for the movie through a totally different medium. This method of doing things was not even available just a few years ago, but it will expand for filmmakers, writers, musicians, and other artists with every passing year. That is, if they are not reluctant to use technology. Many older artists and writers are especially timid when it comes to the vast array of digital resources now available to them, and I try to encourage anyone I run across to learn how it can be useful to them in their work. There is actually a Silicon Valley term that I've modified to describe people who shy away from these latest technologies. It's called tech debt, and it translates into ones getting behind in those tech areas that can be of immense help to them as time goes on. So what are my lessons? You have to make a living, but you need to also do your own work. You always need a side project, a book, a film, a screenplay, photography, painting, poetry, music, whatever it is. You must not let your job make your personal work totally subservient. You will find that what you learn from your side project eventually will either make you more successful at your career, or it will become your career. That's the story of one guy from that long list of credits at the end of the movie. It is what happened to a person who is trying to lead a creative life and still make a living. I sometimes wonder if the movie moguls I worked with ever have as much fun as I do. After all, how many steaks can you eat? This concludes Inside the Star Wars Empire by Bill Kimberlin, narrated by Johnny Heller, a member of SAG-AFTRA. Copyright 2018 by Bill Kimberlin. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with the Roman and Littlefield Publishing Group, Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.